Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to examine journalistic coverage of wars past and, this by way of reflecting on the relativism of some of the news that we have in all likelihood been getting, or the in all likelihood relativism, that's not good English, but the probable relativism, that's good English, of some of the news that we've been getting with regard to the war in Yugoslavia. It's really more than a war in Kosovo. This is being recorded, by the way, on April 18th of 1999 for the benefit of people who eventually hear the program on tape. And although I take issue with both what the Serbs are doing and with what NATO is doing, I think that it's important to understand that in all likelihood we're not getting the truth from either side. And I would take the news that's coming out about what the Serbs have allegedly done with a generous dose of salt. Falsifying coverage of wars is not something new to this country, nor is it something that is the exclusive province of the government itself, but rather an interplay of public and private institutions. Without further ado, we're going to get right down to this analysis. We're going to begin with a shocking deep-sixing of a story that covered a war past, namely the Vietnam War, a war that spawned the term credibility gap, a term that applied to the lack of credibility that the U.S. government eventually had with its own citizens with regard to war reportage. We're going to be relying for the first part of this broadcast on the censored 1999, subtitled The News That Didn't Make the News. This is the product of Project Censored, which many people may be aware of, and the authors of this were Peter Phillips and Project Censored. The book was put out in softcover by Seven Stories Press and copyright 1999. By the way, there's an introduction by Gary Webb, the author of the Dark Alliance series about the CIA and cocaine for the San Jose Mercury News, who was deep six journalistically for that story. In the summer of 1998, CNN broke a story about the alleged use of nerve gas by American special operations personnel on Americans who were described as defectors. This story created an enormous journalistic firestorm, and the producers of the story, Jack Smith and April Oliver, were summarily dismissed from CNN, despite the fact that there was considerable credibility to the story that they were reporting. And we're going to begin with an article from, once again, Censored 1999, The News That Didn't Make the News by Peter Phillips and Project Censored, softcover, Seven Stories Press, copyright 1999. This article by April Oliver, the story of the story that she and Jack Smith produced, and the story of how they were dismissed from CNN for their work. This article is entitled The Censored Side of the CNN Firings Over Tailwind. Operation Tailwind was the code name for, or the alleged code name for this story, for the operation, I should say. Again, this operation involved U.S. Special Operations personnel from the Special Operations Group, or SOG, allegedly using sarin nerve gas on defectors in Southeast Asia. The article reads, and again, this is by April Oliver, one of the two co-producers who was dismissed, "We as television producers are accustomed to being behind the scenes. The furor of the past few months has, however, shifted my co-producer Jack Smith and me to center stage. We are grateful for the opportunity to put our views forward, particularly at a time when so many powerful people, from the Pentagon to Time Warner, are trying to kill the Tailwind story. Last July, in what was perhaps a first for broadcast journalism, our story was retracted, not based on any known error or fabrication. CNN did not, and could not, say the story was wrong. The report, after all, featured the direct, on-camera testimony of the officers and men who actually fought on the Tailwind mission." That last sentence again, because it's critical. "The report, after all, featured the direct, on-camera testimony of the officers and men who actually fought on the Tailwind mission. The Tailwind report was retracted by CNN based on a new standard of proof that for these volatile charges of nerve gas use and a hunt for defectors, according to Ted Turner, it was necessary to have enough airtight proof to persuade a jury in a courtroom of law. It was a demand for a smoking gun 3 weeks after the fact. Such a smoking gun is, of course, completely counter to the intent of a so-called black operation," unquote. the purpose of which is to cover up the truth so no one can ever prove what happened. By the way, parenthetically, I would add this last couple of sentences highlights one of the difficulties in covering the world of intelligence and covert operations. They are specifically intended to be hidden from view. And so as April Oliver has noted, there's rarely a smoking gun. And reports of these operations can be readily dismissed and usually are dismissed as, quote, conspiracy theory, unquote. Continuing, April Oliver writes, "We stand by the story. We are not novices at news gathering who slapped this report together to garner headlines. The Tailwind story was carefully researched and reported over 8 months with our boss's approval of each interview request and every line of the story's script. It was based on the accounts of multiple sources, from senior military officials to first-hand participants, some of whom paid high compliments to the Tailwind broadcast even after the controversy ignited. A former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, as well as two other confidential sources, read and approved the script prior to airing. All these men who stepped forward to talk about a black operation during President Nixon's secret war in Laos displayed great courage and should be commended." Amen. And note that the story had the endorsement of a chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff before it was released. Continuing, "In addition to the more than half dozen on-camera sources that confirmed or supported the Tailwind story, more than a dozen pilots told us of the availability or use of a special last resort gas that they called, quote, nerve gas, killer gas, drop-dead gas, sleeping gas, GB, unquote, the military name for sarin, or CBU-15, a sarin cluster bomb. The veterans of the elite and covert world of black operations, the SOG, were pledged to secrecy. We told the CNN executives in charge that they should expect strident denials from the military establishment, even from some of the sources who had privately confirmed the story to us. We knew a paper trail proving the story was probably non-existent. Documents were likely to have been sterilized in order to prove the military innocent of any wrongdoing. References to the gas would likely be changed to tear gas and the target some nameless bridge. Please keep in mind that this unit was the most highly trained killing force that the United States had ever produced, some of them trained in delivering backpack nukes. Special weaponry, disinformation, and denial are tools of the trade for the secret elite special operations unit. Plausible deniability for the U.S. government is the golden rule for these commandos." Almost immediately after broadcasting, CNN was bombarded with a chorus of denials from vets, as well as such luminaries as Henry Kissinger and Richard Helms. Soon after, we were booted sky-high out CNN's front door, with CNN top executives denying their part in approving the story. Since the broadcast and our firing, however, we have received even more leads regarding similar missions. In addition, CNN's most experienced investigative reporter, John Camp, interviewed a veteran on camera who described killing four defectors by calling in nerve gas on a 1970 raid into Cambodia. In a memo to CNN management, Camp detailed his extensive background check of the veteran and said that he seemed extremely reliable, unquote. The videotapes detailing this entirely separate mission to kill defectors were in the hands of CNN's management at the time we were fired. Two lawyers paid by CNN, CNN General Counsel David Kohler, K-O-H-L-E-R, and Corporate Attorney Floyd Abrams, wrote a hasty justification for the retraction, calling that report independent, unquote, as a fraud. Simply put, the Abrams-Kohler report is a vehicle for a corporate whitewash. CNN wanted to cut and run because they couldn't take the heat from the mobilized vets Henry Kissinger and Colin Powell. Whatever happened 28 years ago in the rainforests of Laos wasn't nearly as important to CNN as what will happen in the next war. CNN's bread and butter is covering of conflict around the globe. Corporate calculus showed that they needed the Pentagon more than they needed us. And again, the interplay of public and private institutions in the deep-sixing of important war news is exemplified in that last couple of sentences by April Oliver. Continuing with this article, "At the heart of this controversy, I see the issue of freedom. Do Americans have the right to know, the freedom to pursue knowledge of government secrets 28 years after the fact? Or should knowledge of certain government activities be forever denied? In this brave new world of media mega-mergers, is a free press alive and well? or our corporate values dictating what news is. At the time the controversy ignited, we, the producers, were gagged by CNN management while they solicitously listened to complaints from the military establishment, such as those from retired General Perry Smith. Allow me to say that General Smith did not participate on the Tailwind mission and is not a veteran of special operations. He comes from the conventional side of the Air Force. He is precisely the sort of, quote, fine upstanding soldier, unquote, that the covert operatives desire to keep information hidden from, compartmentalizing information and sterilizing the paper trail to ensure that the Pentagon establishment has complete and total plausible deniability of such activities. Representatives such as General Smith can make a convincing case that these actions simply did not happen. But a former SOG commander, retired General John Singlau, bragged to us on camera, quote, "We went to great lengths to conceal what we were doing," unquote. General Singlau also said on TV recently that when SOG op missions, that Special Operations Group missions, were compromised, there would be no way for anyone back at the Pentagon to tell what really happened. "We made a good faith effort to find out what really happened on Tailwind, and we had sources well positioned to tell us what occurred. In retrospect, I sincerely regret obeying CNN's order not to speak to the press, as we could have easily corrected the hearsay and military disinformation." Beginning again, "In retrospect, I sincerely regret obeying CNN's order not to speak to the press, as we could have easily corrected the hearsay and military disinformation floating around as facts. These included such egregiously inaccurate assertions as, quote, 'Sarin kills by one droplet to the skin,' unquote." Think back to the Tokyo subway attack, where 6,000 people were exposed to a small amount of sarin gas in a confined space. Only 12 people died. Sarin kills when inhaled. The U.S. servicemen had special chemical masks. Another charge is that I used discredited repressed memory tactics to force the secrets out of a Special Forces veteran. I did no such thing, as the transcripts of each interview prove. A final charge is that I badgered these hardened combat veterans into saying things they really did not mean. Imagine a 36-year-old pregnant lady bulldozing Rambo. We expected the military disinformation campaign. What we did not predict were the attacks by colleagues in the press or the lack of courage by our own company, CNN, to stand by us. CNN executives became jello-kneed at the thought of congressional hearings with the establishment on one side of the room, and CNN teamed up with Special Forces vets on the other. CNN President Rick Kaplan told us flatly in a meeting that he did not want to proceed to congressional hearings with CNN on the opposite side of the room from retired General Colin Powell. As Kaplan explained it to us, quote, "This is not a journalism problem, it is a public relations problem," unquote. Please note that the continuing controversy still centers mostly around the question of nerve gas. Very little outcry in the press has been about the issue of whether defectors were targeted or killed. Perhaps one reason is that a retired four-star Army general has privately conceded to CNN management that defectors were indeed legitimate military targets during the Vietnam conflict. This flatly flies in the face of the Pentagon's continued assertion that there were only two known defectors during the Vietnam War. We are surprised that the public has not demanded more explicit accounting from the Pentagon on this topic. In July, CNN's press officers publicly stated, "The story is dead." This official view was reflected in statements by CNN management on the day of the retraction that, quote, "We're going to try and kill this thing, drive a stake through its heart and bury it so it's gone," unquote. This is the speech of a corporate warrior defending the mother company. It is not the speech of a journalist intent on fact-finding. It's as if CNN itself had adopted the military tactic of plausible deniability, unquote. Soon after CNN retracted the story, the Pentagon came out with its own report on the Tailwind mission. At a press conference featuring members of that mission, Secretary Cohen declared that nerve gas had obviously not been used because so many Americans had survived. Secretary Cohen's remarks are disingenuous. As Secretary of Defense, he must certainly know that there are different kinds of nerve gas and that the nerve gas we report was used in Operation Tailwind was sarin gas. As mentioned earlier, sarin does not kill through skin contact, it kills when inhaled. The Pentagon's leading chemical authority, General Walter Busby, admitted this to CNN on camera. So Cohen's opening remarks immediately signaled a whitewash designed to mislead the public about the nature of the gas which we report was employed. Our many sources confirm that so many American servicemen survived precisely because nerve gas was used. The Americans had the right protective masks, the enemy didn't. After all, the Americans and their Montagnard team were completely surrounded, out of ammunition, 100% wounded, and out in the open with three enemy anti-aircraft guns bearing down on them from a ridge about 1,000 meters before them. The only tactical advantage the American SOG team had was possession of M-17 protective gas masks. Scores of enemy died that day, and every single American made it out alive from this dire last resort situation. The gas worked. Ironically, the two gentlemen that the Pentagon and Secretary Cohen marched in front of the press corps last summer to represent the Tailwind Heroes were the same two veterans who had, over the course of our 8-month report, changed their story so many times that we almost lost track. One of these vets, captain of the mission Eugene McCarley, declared to CNN on camera, quote, "If being cross-border was considered unethical or deniable, I reckon I was never there," unquote. McCarley suggests he will deny anything and everything related to Tailwind. Then there was the other vet, Medic Doc Rose. In contrast to nearly every other man on the mission, he swore to CNN up front early in our research that no gas was used at all. The only reason he put on his gas mask, he said, was to protect himself from the, quote, crap, unquote, kicked up by the helicopter. He later amended that story to say that the gas used was awful stuff, unquote. He doesn't know what it was, but he doesn't think it was CS tear gas. After the broadcast, his only comment about the show was that we showed the wrong gas mask, one with external instead of internal filters. He also said that he was required to carry extra atropine, nerve gas antidote, on that mission. At the Soldier of Fortune press conference later in June, however, Rose arrived at his new and final position. It was merely CS tear gas that was used. As Alexander Coburn wrote last summer regarding the Pentagon's whitewash of Tailwind, whatever the final word may be on this story, there was something absurd about the Pentagon being treated as a credible witness. Remember, the Pentagon and the CIA conducted a secret air war in Laos, which involved dropping high explosives every 8 minutes on average for many years. At the end of the war, one-third of the population had become refugees. By 1971, the CIA was practicing a scorched-earth policy in Hmong territory against the incoming Pathet Lao. The land was drenched with herbicides which killed the rice and opium crops and also poisoned the Hmong amid the attack on Smith and Oliver, the fact that the Pentagon had an inventory of over 30 million pounds of sarin, some of it in Southeast Asia, was mentioned but never explored. By the way, I would add that the main covert air war was actually in Cambodia, although there was certainly plenty of action in Laos. Continuing. Coburn's was one of the few pieces which placed the Operation Tailwind story in context. The time when Nixon was running secret wars with separate chains of command, when officers were getting fragged by their men, when the chemicals Agent Orange and napalm were being used liberally by the U.S. military, and when it was not technically illegal for the U.S. to use nerve gas, as the Senate had not yet ratified the Geneva Protocol. Yet most of the media coverage neglected such details, instead honing in on us, the messengers. Amateurs, they called us, left-leaning ideologues, unquote. For the record, my only political job was with Reagan's 1980 presidential campaign. The name-calling, however, successfully shifted attention away from what the highly secret unit SOG was, what their rules of engagement were, and what weapons they had at their disposal. It's an age-old tactic of warfare. Kill the messenger, obliterate the message. Some of the veterans who ran the disinformation campaign came forward to crow about their kill. They boasted to Forbes magazine and others about how they did indeed mount a pressure campaign on CNN, utilizing the power of the Internet to gather sources, and then bombarded the CNN executive suite with a letter-writing campaign and threats to boycott. There is a website devoted to the disinformation campaign at www.greenberet.com, one of which sports pictures of a dozen body bags, one with our names and images on it with blood oozing out of our heads. Make no mistake about it, these guys regard this as warfare, and we were their target. A family member who was a Texas A&M graduate, a veteran, and a former officer in the Chemical Weapons Corps recently wrote to me to say, quote, "Your job as a journalist is to keep the public properly and accurately informed. The job of the military is to defend the country. The real clash comes in deciding where secrecy is justified, to what degree, and for how long. Even the most honest, well-intentioned leaders disagree on where the line should be between secrecy and complete disclosure. You have succeeded in doing what journalists are charged with doing, that is, to move the line ever closer to openness and ever away from unnecessary or, even worse, self-serving cover-up," unquote. Such insight helps to fight the bitterness of suddenly being unemployed. Unemployed, even though CNN management had vetted the script carefully, knew the depth and breadth of our sources, and CNN lawyers had approved every word. After the broadcast, CNN President Rick Kaplan even sent me white orchids along with high accolades. We believe CNN's treatment of us is transparent and calls into question the integrity of that company, as well as its commitment to investigative journalism. I think for the most part this article speaks for itself. A couple of points I want to underscore in addition to the ones that I already have emphasized. First, returning back to the main text of the article, a retired four-star Army general has privately conceded that defectors were indeed legitimate military targets during the Vietnam conflict. And as April Oliver points out, again reading a section, this flatly flies in the face of the Pentagon's continued assertion that there were only two known defectors during the Vietnam War. One of the questions that I have is whether perhaps these were actually defectors or whether perhaps they were prisoners of war who were, for one reason or another, in possession of information that was deemed too sensitive for them to be allowed to live. Perhaps they had knowledge about covert operations that officially never took place. Perhaps they knew about some of the CIA drug running that was taking place. Bear in mind that this operation did take place in Laos, one of the epicenters of the Air America opium traffic. The whole issue of prisoners of war left behind, in particular people who were involved in covert operations, is a very emotional and controversial one. And again, I wonder whether perhaps these were in fact prisoners and perhaps people who had been involved in or had knowledge of sensitive covert operations and were deemed basically too sensitive to be allowed to live. I would also point out that one of the ways that the opponents of this story, mostly Special Forces veterans and related elements, were able to mount the pressure campaign that resulted in the story being deep-sixed, was to use the internet to gather sources and then to bombard the CNN executive suites with letters. This is also a tactic that other people can utilize. If they utilize the media and the internet, they too can perhaps have an effect on the media establishment. That again from Censored, 1999. We're going to conclude this half-hour segment by examining a couple of stories on the same topic and from two different editions of the very same newspaper, this in relation to another war of the past, this the Gulf War. We're going to begin by taking a look at the San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, April 15th of 1999. Now, bear in mind that both of these stories occupy the same column in the newspaper. Both of them occupy the same amount of print space. Both of them are AP stories. Both deal with Gulf War syndrome, and yet they are two fundamentally different articles with different focal points. I'm going to begin by reading the one-star edition story. This is an AP story, Dateline San Diego, headlined, "Potential Gulf War Illness Panacea Tested," subtitled "Study, Mysterious Ailment May Be Bacteria-Linked." The article reads, 30 military and veterans clinics across the country will start this month offering an antibiotic as a possible cure for thousands of veterans who say they suffer from Gulf War syndrome. The medicine is based on a theory that the unexplained symptoms are caused by an airborne bacteria and may be contagious. "We're not dealing with a black plague," unquote, said Dr. Charles Engel, director of the Gulf War Health Center at Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C. The $8 million study is one of two sponsored by the Defense Department and the Veteran Affairs Department. A $12 million study will test exercise and behavior changes as a possible cure. An estimated 100,000 of the 700,000 Gulf War troops report suffering from extreme fatigue, joint and muscle pain, concentration and memory problems, rashes, fever, diarrhea, and other symptoms of Gulf War syndrome. There are about 120 U.S. government projects investigating the cause, characteristics, and prevalence of the illnesses. In the antibiotic study, researchers will look for strains of mycoplasma, a bacteria known to cause some plant and animal diseases. If the bacteria is found to be the cause, it means the conditions can be treated, but that the sufferers are likely mildly contagious. Huntington Beach biochemist Garth Nicholson is one of the first to propose a link between bacteria and the veteran's symptoms. He found the bacteria Mycoplasma fermentans in the blood of almost half of the 600 Gulf War veterans he tested, and in almost all family members of infected veterans. Nicholson said he found that veterans showed improvement after they were treated with an antibiotic called doxycycline. The researchers said that he had monitored the veterans' progress since 1995 and that 75% have fully recovered. If the antibiotic doesn't work, that doesn't mean mycoplasma will be eliminated as the cause of the illness. Quote, "We may not have the right drug or the right dose. You've got to start someplace," unquote, said Dr. Sam Donta, D-O-N-T-A, an infectious disease specialist at the Boston Veterans Affairs Medical Center who was leading the antibiotic study. He will test doxycycline on 450 Gulf War veterans who test positive for mycoplasma. Half of them will take the antibiotic daily for a year, while the other half will take a placebo. None will know whether they are taking the antibiotic or the placebo. Researchers will test all participants for mycoplasma infection after 6 months, a year, and 6 months after they finish the drug. In the second study, 1,360 veterans will test whether exercise and cognitive behavioral therapy, unquote, either separately or in combination, can ease symptoms of the illness. In a two-hour program featuring not only Dr. Garth Nicholson, the microbiologist referred to here, but also Dr. Len Horowitz, Dr. Alan Cantwell, and Ed Haslam, author of Mary Fairy and the Monkey Virus, we dealt with the mycoplasma as source of Gulf War syndrome. That program is excerpted into a pair of half-hour segments, also available from Spitfire, about Gulf War syndrome. This particular mycoplasma appears to have been genetically engineered with a gene from HIV, the AIDS virus, spliced into it to make it even more pathogenic. And as we saw in our discussion with Dr. Nicholson, it appears that the Iraqis may very well have gotten this specially genetically engineered mycoplasma from the United States and used it in munitions used on U.S. troops. Now, that was the earlier one-star edition. The San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, April 5th, 1999's four-star edition carried the following AP story. This, however, is datelined Washington, not San Diego. It's by Laura Myers of the AP. It's headlined U.S. GIs in Gulf not hit by toxics. Pentagon, exposure to chemicals unlikely. And this story has no mention whatsoever of the mycoplasma. Gulf War veterans likely were not exposed to chemical warfare agents at an industrial site in Kuwait, and troops weren't harmed by exposure to depleted uranium, the Pentagon concluded Thursday. The military would not rule out the possibility of chemical exposure, however. The reports are the result of an investigation the Defense Department has been conducting to determine the cause of mysterious illnesses reported by thousands of Gulf War veterans. Bernard Roster, a defense official in charge of Gulf War syndrome issues, said a review of circumstances surrounding the 1991 U.S. troop presence near a cement factory outside Kuwait City suggests soldiers weren't exposed to any suspected chemical warfare agents inside. The Pentagon found no evidence during a review of tapes from special Fox military vehicles that can detect nuclear, biological, and chemical agents, and from soil analysis. The rest of the story goes on to deal with the whole issue of chemical exposure and the possibility of Gulf War syndrome stemming from depleted uranium. There is no mention of the mycoplasma. This concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.